Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Adrian Hemond and Brian Began. These guys are with Grassroots Midwest, part of that Grassroots Midwest team. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for bringing us in.
Well, we're going to have Tom Kasperson, state senator and congressional candidate in the 1st District, join us a little later. But first, guys, the filing deadline was on Tuesday. We had the withdrawal deadline on Friday. So we know now officially who's in these 110 House districts. Now, Brian, you helped draw this exact state House map that we're looking at right now. Some might argue that you were the main architect in drawing these lines. From your perspective here, as you're looking at these lines as they're drawn now, when you were going through the process, tell our listeners a little bit of the thought and what kind of Republican bent was kind of given these districts.
Well, everything was done fair and legal, I have to say that. But the main thing is that we wanted to watch for county breaks and just kind of take into account areas that were more friendly to Republicans, like, because we knew that we were going to have to defend this map during three presidential cycles. So you had to take that into account. So I'm pretty confident in Republicans holding on.
You know, it's kind of interesting, too, because when you look at the lines, the goal here is no county breaks. And if you can keep municipalities together, that's a key, too, because that helps defend it in court. And so some of these districts kind of look a little funny, but it's because the city boundaries are a little funny. And I'm looking at maybe Dearborn Heights, which is kind of separated kind of oddly. Brownstown Township is separated into three different geographical blocks, even though it's one township, for example. You know, Wixom looks a little strange, but that kind of cuts across the line. So that's something that you take into consideration. And then the precincts as well. I mean, you got to get down to the precinct by precinct level here, too.
Yeah, that's true. You got to get into the precinct level. But at the same time, you have to make sure the population is similar to each district. And when you split like a municipality, the margin is probably plus or minus two at that point. So it's a lot smaller differential between the two. When you get into like areas like Ann Arbor, which is a very funny city, you get the islands, and because they're non-contiguous, it's easy to work around. But like with Brownstown Township, it's difficult just because of the way it's all lined up.
And so now when you're taking a look at this map in 2016, what do you think the Republicans' chances are of keeping a majority, considering that, you know, things are going kind of a different way right now, but these maps were designed in a way to keep Republicans a majority?
Oh, that's correct. I feel that presidential years are always tough for Republicans just because of the way the turnout is with the extra 10,000 per district. But I feel pretty good for the most part. I think best case scenario, Republicans only lose one seat, but historically, probably about 5 to 6 at least.
Adrian, I'm going to guess that you're going to disagree here. How many seats do you see, taking a look at the map, looking at what happened on filing deadline, how many seats do you see Democrats losing as of today, knowing that this will change, I'm sure?
You know, right now, I think it's pretty likely that Democrats will pick up at least the 5 seats that Brian's talking about. My prediction for this election cycle is 8, which would put us on shared control.
Going on the shared control?
Absolutely.
How exciting.
I'm on the shared control train. As Brian will tell you, since he drew the map, the map is basically drawn to sustain a Republican majority as long as the top of the ticket in a presidential year gets to about 47%. You need to get into the high 40s as a Republican at the top of the ticket in order not to start losing some of these seats, whereas Republicans, you probably should win. Given the churn that's going on at the top of the ticket right now, how poorly Donald Trump performs with women, with minorities, in some of these strategically important districts, I think Democrats have got a little bit more of a leg up than they should if Republicans had a sort of traditional top of the ticket. Some of the people that have dropped out of the race already, a Marco Rubio, a Jeb Bush, were very likely to get into that 47% range. And if you hit 47% statewide as a Republican, you feel pretty good with this map. I don't think that the Republican nominee is going to hit 47% in Michigan, and that's why I'm predicting the 8 seats that flip and we get the shared control.
It's interesting how we're talking about the presidential race when we're talking about state House districts, and it just goes to show you how important what happens on the top of the ticket is, because for as much shoe leather and spending that goes on in these individual districts, if the top of the ticket tanks, it doesn't matter what you do. in some cases, does it, Brian?
Yeah, that's correct. With getting rid of straight ticket voting might help a little bit, but not a lot, just because of how close the state house is to top of the ticket. But if you have someone like a Ted Cruz or Donald Trump that goes and lays an egg, that's going to hurt Republicans down ticket. At least if a Republican gets about 47%, yeah, that's, you know, the base in Michigan, that's going to help Republicans kind of keep their strength. But then if you get like 41%, whereas like McCain did, and he's only winning in 33 House seats, any sort of extra push Republicans could use in these marginal seats like the 99th or the 101st is gone, because the top of the ticket is just dragging you down to such an extent. And you need them to perform well in order to like maintain at least just your base.
Taking a look now at some of these districts, obviously populations shift over the course of 10 years, and so we're, you know, more than halfway through with this map here. Have either of you guys seen particular population shifts as far as base numbers that is notable? Some areas getting more Republican, some areas getting more Democratic?
You know, I don't know that it's due to a population shift, but I think during the life of the Obama presidency, we've seen some political shift in far northern Michigan, especially the Upper Peninsula. You know, the UP and northern lower Michigan were represented for, you know, a good decade and a half by Bart Stupak, a conservative Democrat. Democrats have not been performing as well in the Upper Peninsula. And, you know, this year, some of these House elections are going to put some of that to the test. You've got a competitive open House seat in the 108th District, currently occupied by Representative Ed McBroom, where the Democrats have a rock star candidate. If Democrats can't win that seat, and I think that they will, but if Democrats can't win that seat, it's time to seriously reevaluate how much time and treasure you're spending in portions of the Upper Peninsula where things might be trending away from you. I think ultimately they grab that seat, but if they don't, it's time for some introspection.
And then also you take a look at maybe the 106th, the 101st, kind of the same kind of situation. What about Metro Detroit, Brian? What do you think we're seeing here in, let's say, this Wayne County area here, parts of Oakland County?
Yeah, a lot of that has actually started to shift more left, because you look at just Canton, you know, you go back like a decade, it was a Republican-leaning area. Now it's pretty solidly Dem, and you see that in some of the other areas like Farmington Hills, used to be a competitive seat, not anymore. Same thing with Royal Oak. And those are just areas that if you look at just the way the base goes, and West Bloomfield for that matter, they've just had a very steady shift left.
And so these are districts then that are almost just taken off the table for Republicans. And I also think of the Dearborn seat. I remember when Gary Warnchek held that as a Republican. It's kind of fun to think about right now with a big-time wrestler in the race there in Dearborn. But that's not a realistic situation there.
No, it's not. It's about 40% base. Again, going back to 2004 when Gary Warnchek won, it might have been narrowly 50%. But just the way things have changed since 2000, it is out of reach for Republicans to reasonably even think about playing in there.
And the next one to watch, and I don't know that it'll flip this cycle, but the next one to watch in Southeast Michigan is House District 41, City of Troy and Clawson. The City of Troy, all in, is more than 20% Asian now. And given the way that Republicans have trended lately on social issues, you know, the sort of Christian dominionism posture doesn't fare very well with Hindus and East Asians who may not subscribe to any sort of Christian religion. That's a potential problem spot. Neither party has done a great job reaching out into the Indian American community in particular, Pakistani American communities, and there are a lot of professionals, doctors, attorneys, etc., in that sort of Troy-Clawson area from South and East Asia. Whichever party is able to capture that, they've got some real opportunity there, both in terms of votes and to raise money.
You know, and I'm going to say, and I don't know if this is going to trend Democratic, Republican, or whatnot, but the 52nd district in Washtenaw County is exploding as far as population goes. When we were doing our little exercise a few weeks ago in which we saw how the presidential candidates did in individual races, that 52nd district, the numbers were just huge. I know that they've got four House districts right now in Washtenaw County, and the next time we redraw this map, it wouldn't surprise me if we get up to another one, or at least part of another one.
Yeah, that's right. Probably 4.5, or at least it'll break into like possibly Wayne County. If Wayne County's population continues to go down, I could see them losing seats. And you could see that breaking into like Canton area or even Plymouth, depending on who's controlling redistricting, really depends on how it's going to shift, because you have the Ypsilanti area, and they may, and Democrats may want to break into a little bit more Republican area to kind of help them out by balancing it out with the heavy Ipsy. So,
now, we had Craig Mauger here last week from the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He argued that this election is the best opportunity that Dems have to pick up seats to gain the majority and then hold that pocket of votes that they have into the redistricting of 2021 or 2020. I wanted to get you guys' perspective on that.
It's possible, but then again, people would have said that about Democrats in 2008, but we saw a 2010 wave came around and wiped that all away. Now, yeah, they'll definitely pick up some seats, but now if they wouldn't have done so poorly the previous cycle, they'd be in a much better chance to take majority. But by losing 3-4 seats, you kind of really put them at a disadvantage. So, yeah, they could pick up seats, but then again, the Republicans have a few chances to pick some up, you know, 2 years from now. But then again, that's so far away in political years.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's one of the big stories of this year's elections for the Michigan House of Representatives that's being talked about less is how badly hurt House Democrats are by what happened last cycle. They lost 4 seats last cycle. If they had been able to hold serve in that gubernatorial year, they'd be looking to only pick up 5 seats, and I'd be running around town saying that it was a sure thing the majority is going to flip. I don't think that 5 seats in a presidential year with the way the map is drawn and what the top of the ticket looks like is that tall an order. Historically speaking, the fact that they lost 4 last cycle has really put them behind the 8 ball. It's really the best thing other than the map that House Republicans have going for them right now is how poorly House Democrats performed last cycle.
Last thing I want to ask you, Brian, if the Democrats do take control and they get to control the pen in 2021, how much differently do you think this map realistically can look? I mean, is it something that the average voter would notice, or is it only something that nerds like us would actually appreciate?
I think it's just something us nerds would do, because there's like maybe a few little differences. Yeah, the way, like the 39th district, it might be all West Bloomfield and just cut into like Waterford, you know, little changes. It wouldn't change the amount of municipal breaks or county breaks, but just one little going one direction versus the other is enough to maybe like shift it a little bit more Dem. But then again, with the Dem concentration so centralized in like southeast Michigan, yeah, you're not going to see too much difference up north.
All right. Brian Began, Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Joining us now for the podcast is Senator Tom Casperson. Joining us in the media room here in the Capitol. Your first time down here.
First time in a media room. This is impressive.
Yeah. The only thing I don't like about it is this constant hum that we got back here, but I don't think that will pick up too bad here for the podcast. Well, filing deadline is come and gone. We've got 3 Republicans running in the first congressional district. Obviously, you know Jason Allen well, but we've got a newcomer, Jack Bergman, who hails from the UP. What do you know about him?
I really don't. I don't know him. I met him the other night for the first time. Seemed like a decent guy, but I don't know him. We asked some folks we know over in the Bessemer area if they know him, and they don't know him either. I think being a military guy, he's traveled probably the world and spent a lot of time serving in the military, and we want to thank him for that service. But I don't think he spent a lot of time in the Upper Peninsula and certainly over in Bessemer and Wakefield area, but we'll see.
Give our listeners a little handicap. The first congressional race on the Republican side, the primary. Tell us how you see it right now.
Well, it was shaping up to look like it was going to happen between Jason and I, but then the general got into it. So now it seems like he probably will take some votes away from both of us, and then it's going to come down to the race between Jason and I, the way I see it. We both have history, and we both have districts that we've served in. The unknown will be the East End, the Alpena area that neither Jason or I have served over there. And so I think the three-way race probably will mix it up a little bit and make everything a little closer.
Now, you said you think that the general will take votes away from both you and him. Is it take votes away from you because you're both UP and then some from him because he's military?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. I mean, if he's coming from the UP, there might be some UPers that might look at him and maybe give him a look and consider voting for him. But he's also an unknown in that he has no record. So people will kind of hard to judge him one way or the other. And certainly in the primary, the conservative movement is part of that issue. And are you conservative? Are you not conservative? And how hard right will you vote or hard middle, moderate, whatever it might be. So I think he has a little bit of an advantage that way, where you can't really you can't judge the general because he doesn't have a record to be judged. And so that'll be an interesting outcome.
What is your pitch to voters right now?
I've been talking to people, number one, people that get into this race. I hope they're getting in because they really believe in it and they have passion and what the term we use, fire in the belly. I've never lost that. That was one of the reasons I ran. I came out of an industry that was a family-owned business and thought that's where I'd finish my career, but that changed when some things happened in the industry, and I really had a desire to come down and see that the government was a little more responsive and would listen to people, and that's never changed. And I look at the federal level and what's going on. I am so convinced that the federal government is so much overreached into our lives and into our governing. What I mean by that is that I think the governing should be taking place on the state level. This is where it should be happening. The federal government should make sure that we have the ability to do that and that we're protected and we're safe. But it's gone so far beyond that. There's so much duplication. I would love to see the next president take a serious look at just one department to get started and potentially consider closing down one department just to do it and say that, because I believe life will go on. And I, you know, people ask me what department. I would start with Department of Education. I think Michigan, our state, we can handle it, each state, and I think that competition would be a good thing. It seems like the federal government doesn't want the competition. They want to kind of control it from the top, and I just think that the federal government has overreached way beyond what they should be, and I don't think they're listening to us at all, and that's got to change.
Now, one of the knocks on your candidacy, obviously, is that you've taken some bad votes or perceived bad votes, and maybe you don't see them as bad votes. I'm thinking Medicaid expansion, obviously, and the increase in the gas tax and driver registrations as part of the transportation package. What do you tell your voters back home about those votes?
Well, first of all, I didn't come down here to play politics. I really didn't. I wanted to come in and govern. And so weighing in on all the evidence that I've been given, I think our infrastructure is crumbling, and I think there's been a major problem with our road funding. And the way I've come to that conclusion is look at the other states around us, clearly far ahead of us with their funding for their roads. I border Wisconsin with my district. Wisconsin is clearly ahead of us on their road building projects. Their roads are going forward, whereas we see ours starting to stumble backwards. So I think the evidence is in that there's something wrong there and we need to do something. The Medicaid expansion was the same thing. When you look at it, that problem's got to get fixed in Washington. And we had, as Republicans, we've had three attempts to try and fix it. We had two elections and we had a Supreme Court that we thought was something was going to change, and it didn't. So because of the Obamacare scenario, we're faced with taxes that money is getting taken out of Michigan on a pretty hefty basis, the taxes that Obamacare imposes on our health care premiums, on the medical devices, those type of things. And they're taking that money out of the state right now. And so I looked at it as, if I want to play politics with it, it would have been easier to vote no and just say I don't support Obamacare. Harder to say yes, and until we solve this Obamacare problem in Washington, I'm not going to allow for Washington to take money from our state. We're going to take that money back and use it in our state. And that was what I did. I don't support Obamacare as we see it, and I would vote against it and try to stop it. But I also think we as Republicans better have solutions. We cannot just say no for the political sake of saying no. We better have some real clear solutions on health care, because it's clearly a problem in our country.
So you're okay with these votes as you see it? I mean, they're defendable.
I think they are. If people are willing to look at it and listen, because I've asked people that have opposed what I did, and I've asked them about the taxation that we've got taking place in Michigan right now because of Obamacare. I can't stop that. I cannot deal with the Washington stuff from my level. That has to be taken care of out there. So am I supposed to say no and let that money leave Michigan? Our citizens are having money taken from them. Leave Michigan. For the sake of saying I don't support Obamacare, and I don't get a good answer back. It's like, well, we need to do the right thing. Well, the right thing is clearly to change Obamacare. But that vote didn't do that. It does not do it. And that was why I did it. It wasn't to support Obamacare. It was clearly to not allow what was happening with the money siphoning off of the Michiganders and leaving, and to address what's going on. That's why we push for the amendment that would say that this whole program goes away if the federal government doesn't keep its commitment. That's what that amendment was all about. Because clearly if we take care of Obamacare by getting rid of it and repealing it and come back with something else, then the Medicaid part of it and that tax goes away. So then you deal with that as it happens. But right now, as I said, three bites at the apple and we weren't successful with any one of them.
Right.
And so It's unknown what's going to happen here.
Let's change gears here to this proposal that you put on the table here about gender and bathrooms, right? Folks who are born a certain gender should use a certain bathroom in public schools. Talk about the type of response you have received since that measure has gone out.
Sure. There's what I'm finding happening is, first of all, don't even have a bill. We're having one drafted, so we don't have the version in front of us that I could actually show you and say, here's what we're proposing. And yet I'm hearing people attacking me as if I have a bill and as if I've said things, which I haven't said. Quick example. I am not suggesting that a child struggling with the idea that they have a gender problem that they can't seem to resolve, that we should just more or less tell the child, you know, get over it, and you're going to go to the boys' bathroom if you're a boy, and you're going to go to the girls' bathroom if you're a girl. I've never said that. I think for sure we need to recognize it. We need to be understanding with the child and work with that child. I'm simply suggesting that we shouldn't be blending their biological differences together in these private areas. I find it very interesting that the bulk of this whole debate has become the bathroom issue as far as the Michigan Department of Education's policy. That was not the issue that started my concerns. My issue was the parenting. And for the Department of Education to suggest that a seven-year-old could tell a teacher, I don't want my mom and dad to know, so therefore the school would be required then to not tell the parents about what's going on with their little seven-year-old in school, and then set up an entire policy that would help this child go through this based on the way the school sees it, I think is so far out of bounds it's not even funny. That's the issue. And I think it's the issue because I noticed those that would oppose me doing anything with the Department of Education never bring it up. They never really want to talk about it. Why is that? I think it's because when parents, at least the way I see it and the people I've talked to, when parents find out the Department of Education is willing to go to that level, that would suggest they could set a policy in place that would allow the school to carve the parents right out of the decision-making process. That's unacceptable, and I'll battle that one to the death. We need to include parents, and that's really where I see the major problem. But the same thing goes with the idea that we can just intermingle the biological differences as it's no problem. Yes, I keep hearing that the child struggling with gender doesn't care. If it's a boy, they're thinking more in terms of a girl. So it's not a problem for them. But are we not going to recognize that potentially it could be a struggle for the child in a traditional setting, let's say in a young girl in a locker room setting, traditionally assuming it's going to be girls and boys are boys, that they just have to accept it and they just have to, I don't know, ignore it or go on as if there's no difference there? I think that's asking a lot of our young kids. And so I'm just simply proposing that we listen to the child, we make arrangements for the child, and make sure that if the bathroom arrangements, as an example, that they have arrangements and that we protect them from bullying and everything else that could come from this, make sure that they are protected. And I propose that.
It's not necessarily if you're born a boy, you have to use the boy's bathroom. If you're born a girl, you have to use the girl's bathroom. And that is a stringent policy. That's not what you're putting on the table.
No, I have never suggested that, ever. I've suggested that the school take responsibility and help that child. And I think the appropriate way to go would be with singular bathrooms, administrative bathrooms, and let the child know that they're perfectly welcome to go that route. And if they feel uncomfortable as a boy going into the boy's bathroom because of their gender identity, I think we should respect that. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to just suggest they should be able to go into a private setting of the opposite biological differences that they have, but make provisions for them. And I have two schools in my district right now that have actually dealt with this, and they called me. I won't identify the school because I don't want to identify the child and I don't want this scrutiny on them. But I have been told the same thing. They applied locally, applied exactly what I'm proposing and said it worked just fine. And in fact, it worked well because the kids even have embraced each other. And there's a unity there that they're working with each other and respecting the child that's struggling with the gender issue. So they've actually applied it and it works. So I'm really trying to figure out why the Department of Education hasn't talked to these superintendents, or it seems to me they haven't really done a lot of talking to the locals as to, are you dealing with this? have you dealt with? And if you have, how have you dealt with it? And what's worked and maybe what's not worked? It seems like from Central Command, they've decided they know better than what everybody else does, because I can tell you superintendents I've talked to are not happy with what they see coming out of this. It puts them in a terrible spot that they would have to go this broad if the school board or the Department of Education is requiring it or telling them that you can do this. Then what do they do? What do they do when the child says, I don't want my mom and dad to know? If the policy says, here's what you do, do they go against the policy? My point is, why even put that in there? And it didn't have to be put in there. Had they talked to some of these school districts that have already dealt with it, they could have worked this out, in my opinion. And they decided not to. They decided to move forward. And why did they do it in February? And why wasn't more public notice put out on this? I was told they did this, and they do their board meetings online, so therefore that was their public notice. I really wonder how many parents go online to see what the Michigan Department of Education is doing on any given moment. And I think they know better than that, and that was really unacceptable, their answer. I think the public had a right to know about this. And let's have that open debate and be honest with each other, not make up stuff as we go.
Senator Tom Casperson, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Senator Tom Casperson for the time today, and also Brian Began and Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest. I'm Kyle Mullen, editor of the MERS newsletter. Thanks again for joining us. Until next week.